Hi, everybody. My name is Barbara Anderson. I'm a very grateful Al-Anon. And I'm very glad you're here. Our topic this morning is the gift of hope. Our three Al-Anon meetings over the weekend are hope, healing, and happiness. The gifts of hope, healing, and happiness. And this meeting is focusing primarily on the first three steps, but on that beginning process, the miracle that begins to happen in those steps. This afternoon's meeting is being led by Judy and Sulita, and they're going to be doing the gift of healing. And then on Saturday night, we have the gift of happiness with Lou and with Sherry. So someone asked me to please read my 12 steps before Al-Anon, so I'm going to start with that, and then I'm going to turn it over to my very wonderful friend Linda, who is going to get us started. Number one, I discovered that I was powerful over others and that your lives were certainly unmanageable. Two, came to believe that I was the power that could restore you to sanity. Three, made your decision for you to turn your will and life over to the care of me. Four, made a searching and fear-filled inventory of everyone that I knew and found them lacking. Five, admitted to God, myself, and anyone that would listen the exact nature of your wrongs. Six, became entirely ready to assist you in removing all your defects of character. Seven, humbly, assisted you in removing your defects of character, except when to do so would cause me harm. Eight, made a list of all persons that had harmed me and vowed to get even with them all. Nine, waited and waited and waited and waited for everyone to make direct amends to me. 10, continued to take your inventory, and when you were wrong, promptly pointed it out. 11, sought through martyrdom, mothering, managing, and manipulating to improve your conscious contact with me, asking only that you read my mind and carry out my wishes. And 12, having a complete physical, emotional, and spiritual breakdown as a result of this type of living, I tried to drag all those I love down with me and get sympathy and pity from all who would listen. And so you wonder why I needed the 12-step process. You know, that really probably was my life before the steps, so I needed some hope. And to begin our discussion this morning, I'm going to turn it over to Linda.
Thanks, Barbara. Good morning, everyone. My name is Linda Bazans, and I'm a grateful member, okay, of the Al-Anon Family Group Control. I do know why I'm here. I am grateful to be here. And when, and I also want to thank you for all of you who have shown up this morning. I see so many friends in the audience, including my good friend Bob D., who came up earlier to wish me well. When Barbara told me that the subject was the gift of hope, I really, you know how you have, oh yeah, I like that. I like that. So I've really resonated with the topic, and it's been sort of bouncing around ever since. When I came to the program, I came to the program in 1967, and I've had three sponsors during that time. And my first sponsor's name was Jen. My second one's name was Marcy. And my third is Beverly R. from Fort Worth, Texas. And when Marceline was my sponsor, at one point I went up to her and I said, I feel like my program's getting stale, and I want to know what to do to revitalize it. I do my readings and I have my books on my kitchen table, ODAT, Courage to Change, and I was reading them to get them out of the way. And then I had done those, and I found myself getting stale, and I said to her, what can I do to change that? And she said, well, I do a New Year's resolution around my program every year so that it's fresh. And I said, well, yeah, tell me. And she said, well, what we do, I do, you know, new readings. She said, I recommend you put your books away for a year. And why don't we make a deal that we will do a step a month for this coming year? And I said, okay. So January, obviously, was step one, and February, step two, and so on. I have to admit that the first time I made that bargain with her, when I got to step four, I quit because I forgot that I'd have to do an inventory again in April and a fifth step in May. And so I backed out. So I did not complete that. But the next year, I did complete it. But I found myself in January, you know, in the step one says you're powerless over alcohol and your lives have become unmanageable. Day after day, focusing on the powerlessness and the unmanageability, it got heavy because I kept thinking about it, looking at the unmanageability in my life, looking at the unmanageability in my family, looking at the things, which was almost everything, that I had no power over. And it became heavy and it became sad. And about maybe the 20th of January, I could not wait for February because I knew the hope would be added. And finally, it's February 1st, and I could look at step two, and I could say, there is a power greater than me that will restore me to sanity and saneness and wholeness, but also joy. Because step one, if you stay in step one, it's a sad place. I mean, you know, we've been talking a lot about bridges. You almost want to go jump off a bridge. Because if you don't have two, it's sad. And so when February came, I had a whole new awareness about the step. Because hope was added, and it gave me that sense of yes. When we come to Al-Anon, most of us, come because we've run out of our last good idea. We do not want to be in Al-Anon. We are beaten up by the disease of alcohol. We are participants. We are not victims. We think we are. But we've cooperated. But we are still beaten up by the disease. And we come hopeless and helpless and scared, full of anger, full of resentments. Why can't it be the way I want it? If only it were, if only I could make a change. And that's what we come with. And then we're given the gift of hope. And so I started to think about what hope meant and how it translated in my life. And there's a joyfulness when there's something to look forward to. And that's what hope is. It's something to look forward to. When you're living in alcoholism, with alcoholism, either active, I lived with alcoholism and my husband wasn't drinking. And we had alcoholism in our home. And I remember when I did not want to go to Al-Anon. Al-Anon was not on my list of things to do. I only went to look good because a good wife would support their husband and go to Al-Anon. That's why I went. I did not know how much I needed Al-Anon. I just went to look good and to get some tips to make him behave. And I thought once I had those tips and he was different, I would be done with this thing and we would be happy and everything would be fine. I didn't get the tips that I wanted, and yet I got the 12 steps read to me every single meeting. So I got the tips. I got the roadmap. I got the directions. I just didn't recognize them. I didn't recognize them for a long time. And part of the reason I didn't recognize them is because I wasn't willing to work the steps because, see, there was nothing wrong with me. If he were different, if I didn't have alcoholism, things would be okay. And yet I couldn't really tell that to my group for two reasons. One is then they might encourage me to work the steps that I had no intentions of working. And number two, I saw alcoholism in these people's lives. Phones were turned off. There was physical and emotional abuse. There was so much sadness in their life. And what's wrong with me? I'm complaining. My husband's going to too many meetings. And so I feel unworthy and less than, and I can't tell people. And so I just kept getting sicker. But going back to the idea of hope, where do we get hope from? And my answer is God. If we don't have a power greater than ourselves, and we're running the show like we run the show when we think we're doing it right, if it were just my way, everything would be right. Those are funny, you know, that's a funny adaptation, and it's so true. We laugh at it because it's so true. See, if everything were my way, everything would be fine. But that is so far from the truth now. If I cooperate with the way things God has planned for me, everything is more than all right. It's wonderful. We need, I believe we need, but I will say I know I need to have a conscious contact with a power greater than myself. And in the beginning, my contact was named God, and it still is. If it isn't God and it isn't yourself, you're going along the right path. Because so many of us just feel that we have the way, the truth, the answer. And if people would just cooperate with that, everything would be fine. Where do we get that? So my hope today comes from the fact that I know that there is a God. There's a power greater than me who has a plan. And my job is to live in that plan. And that's what step three is to me. So the hope comes in step two. The powerlessness and the unmanageability are still there, but there's hope. And I was a psychiatric nurse, and I didn't like the word insanity because, you see, I didn't have any insanity. I knew what insanity looked like. They had the Thorazine shuffle. I knew what it looked like. I worked with those people. There was nothing wrong with me. There was a lot wrong with me. I came to Al-Anon to fix Bob, and I was given the tools to fix me. So the hope comes in step two, and then in step three, we make a decision, to turn our will and our life over to something bigger than ourselves. And I don't believe that if I don't turn my will and my life over today, God says, too bad, tough deal, you're on your own. You see, I know I'm always in God's care. But step three to me is about cooperation. I have to cooperate with what shows up. I have to say yes to what I'm asked to do. I have to create boundaries so that I can take care of myself, so that I can be of service. So my job is to cooperate, to recognize whatever shows up as the plan, and not to shake my fist at it and ask, why me? Why do I have to do this? Why am I asked? I don't like this. Well, who cares? Who really cares? If I'm supposed to do something, I want to know it. And yes, there are times when I don't like it, but if I come with the sense of cooperation, I like it a whole lot more than if I come with the sense of I know what should happen. We just had an experience. We were in Texas last week, and there was this thing called the Cowboy Church. And I'd heard about it. It has a lot of cowboy music, and they call the kids buckaroos, and I had heard about it and didn't want to go. And Bob said he was going to go, and I said, well, that's fine. You can go. I'm not going to go. And by a series of events, basically, he's asking me again, and, oh, heck, I'll just go. That's what my brain said. And I went, and I enjoyed it, and it was lovely. And so I look one more time at contempt prior to investigation. That's what I am like when I'm not in cooperation. But when I come with the sense of cooperation, yeah, let me take a look at that. Let me think about that. You have a good point there. I'm not sure yet. That's cooperation. That's how it shows up for me. The other one is, no, I'm not going. Because, see, I know I don't want to go. I don't like the fact that I have to get dressed up. I don't want to listen to all that singing. That's not cooperation. So steps 1, 2, and 3 are the foundation of our program. And they are the way that I do my day every day. Before I get out of bed, I do 1, 2, and 3. And hopefully, I live my life in cooperation with a God. But my God is what gives me hope. And my God is what allows me to be the best me I can be in my day, which has been given to me. I'm going to turn it back to you, hon.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'm still Barbara, very grateful, Al-Anon. When I was thinking about hope, I was thinking, and these first three steps, I was thinking about those things I heard early on, the came to, and came to believe. And I love acronyms, so I was trying to come up with an acronym for hope. And what I came up with was honest, which is in our first step, open, which is our second step, prayerful, for P, you know, and through those three things, we become enthusiastic members of this fellowship and are ready to do the rest of the work. And so that's my acronym for you for hope: honest, open, prayerful, and enthusiastic. I came to Al-Anon for all the wrong reasons. I was dating a recovering alcoholic who told me that he wouldn't marry anybody unless they were in Al-Anon. And so I went to meetings to manipulate him into marrying me. And he's running errands today, so I can talk about him. Anyway, it worked. You know, I convinced him that I was working enough of a program to marry me. I really had just come. I was just in the room. I was auditing the course, doing the Cliff Notes version, whatever you want to call it. I was just putting my rear end in a chair, and I was very willing to help all the members of Al-Anon. I thought they probably needed me. And it took me a long time to get past just those steps that I read you earlier. It really did. We got married, and, you know, I was, but the hope began. The seed was planted because I was in the rooms, you know. In those early days of the program, I was jumping around looking for the perfect meeting, you know, and there's a lot of meetings around Atlanta, and I visited most of them, you know, and I would go once or twice to meetings. I also didn't want anybody to really get to know me. I was a wallflower all my life, and so I was a wallflower in Al-Anon, too. I'd arrive at the last minute. People that know me now don't really imagine that I was ever like this, but I was. And I'd arrive at the last minute. I'd sit in the back. I'd run out the door during the prayer. I didn't want anybody to bother me. I didn't want anybody to ask me. I didn't really want to change. And so I found a meeting that was pretty close to where I was living, and I was trying to do that in that meeting, and there was a lady named Beth in that group, and the third time I went to the meeting, she moved and stood in the door before anybody began to start close the meeting, and I couldn't get out the door. And so Beth was hope for me. You know, she stopped me, and she let me know they were glad to have me there and that she was aware that maybe I wasn't really ready to share with anybody, but that she wanted to be sure that I knew that somebody was glad I was there, and she gave me her phone number. And it was that seed of hope, you know. Now, I didn't stay very long. you know. But I thanked her, and it slowly began to make it okay for me to get there early and talk to a few people. I didn't feel comfortable with it. You know, when I think about all the character defects and the person that walked in the rooms of Al-Anon and who I am today, my life has been completely transformed. I mean, the miracle of this program is more than you can ever imagine. I know some people kid about maybe not wanting their family members to be in Al-Anon, but I can tell you unequivocally that Dick and I would not be married today. In our 28th year of marriage, if it was not for this program, you know, and his too, you know, but us working our individual programs is the only reason, really, that we're still together. We have somewhere to go when we want to kill each other, and we don't kill each other, you know. We look at our own part, and that's the miracle transforming part of this program. In 1985, Dick and I went to Al-Anon's first international convention that was part of the AA International in Montreal. And we were headed up there, and we were on an L-1011, which they don't fly anymore because I think they take too much fuel. And someone made an announcement, was there anybody on the plane that was a friend of Bill W.? And there was over 100 people on the plane. And I can imagine that Dick was wonderful at table hopping when he was drinking because he was, you know, seat hopping, talking to everybody on the plane that was in the program. He was so excited, and I never felt more like I didn't fit in. I'd been going to meetings for a year and a half, and I still did not feel like I fit in. I was very uncomfortable. And we got there, and we registered, and everybody was hugging each other on the street. And it wasn't like I wasn't... By that point, I didn't mind being hugged, but I didn't get it. It was overwhelming to me. And because Dick had been to enough AA conventions and he'd hung out with enough family recovery, people in family recovery, AA and Al-Anon couples, he knew everything that Al-Anons try to do to manipulate their alcoholics. And nothing I did ever worked. You know, nothing I ever tried to do to manipulate him to feel sorry for me or to do what I wanted, nothing worked. And we got back to the hotel room that night before the meetings began the next day, and I was hopeless. When I walked in the doors of Al-Anon, I was physically sick. I had ulcers. I had intestinal problems. I had asthma. I had an active eating disorder. I was very depressed. I was suicidal half the time. Nobody had a clue. And I think that's the way many of us arrive in the doors of Al-Anon. Nobody knows because there's that acid is slowly in the middle of us and it's eating us away from the inside out. And we have a wonderful smile on our face and we're there to help everybody. So nobody knows we're dying inside. And I don't think I even had accepted that I was dying inside. But that night, I threatened to commit suicide. I walked in the bathroom and I came out with a razor in my hand and told Dick I thought I was just going to kill myself. And I didn't get the reaction I thought I was going to get. He started laughing at me. Now, before you think he's too cruel, because he did just walk in the door, it was one of those pink Bic Daisy razors, and I had been using it for about, you know, 2 weeks to shave my legs, so I wasn't going to really hurt myself very much. But, and the only one of us that's ever been physical with the other was me. You know, when he started laughing at me, I tried to punch him in the gut, which wasn't very successful. And then I just broke. And I started sobbing. He said, honey, if there's ever a time, I don't know what that is, for you to join Al-Anon for yourself, it might be here. You're at the International Convention, you know. And he said, eventually, you really are going to die. And there's something happened. This voice, that hope that had, those people that stood in the door and talked to me in the meetings, I suddenly went, you know, my life has really been affected by alcoholism. I might actually die if I don't do something. And so we went to the opening meeting that next morning of AA, of Al-Anon's first international convention, and the speaker was Lois Wilson. So when I was ready to work this program for me, Lois was the one that brought the words to me. and I still get goosebumps when I think about what a gift that was. I was sitting in that chair, and she started talking about the miracle of our big three A's, Al-Anon, Alateen, and Alcoholics Anonymous, and this family fellowship that we never had to be alone again. And she talked about the fact that there was not a spiritual side of this program, that it was a spiritual program, that it was a transforming way of living, that we never had to be the same again. And by the time I left that meeting, I had finally taken the first step. I finally admitted that I was powerless and that my life was unmanageable. Now, you know, I thought I could skip over the second and third steps because I was a seminary graduate. And of course, you know, I knew all there was to know about God. And so, but that was really the problem. I had graduated from seminary at the same time the denomination I had chosen to serve had passed a resolution that Eve was the first to sin, and therefore women shouldn't lead over men, and women in ministry would be strongly discouraged. So I graduated and tried to find a job, and time after time after time after time, I was told I was not wanted. And I'm just going to tell you about one of the interviews I went to. I went to an interview in a church in Alabama, and I have no memory of what city, so I know there's a lot of Alabamans here. I don't know what city it was. I don't know the name of the church. I have brownouts. Y'all have blackouts. I have brownouts. My memory, if there's a stressful situation, my memory just blanks it out, you know, so I don't remember. So if you were in the room, don't worry, I won't remember it. But there was a big circle of about 50 chairs and one in the middle, and they ushered me in the room and had me sit in this chair, and the man that was across from me said, "We just wanted to see what someone like you," and I was living in Louisville, Kentucky, by the way, at that time, so I'd driven down, and the man across from me said, "We just wanted to see what someone like you, a woman, who would have the audacity to apply for this job would look like." That's all. And I had driven, you know, 10 hours to get there, and or something like that. Since I don't know where I was in Alabama, I don't really remember exactly how long. And I didn't know what to say. Now, I've thought of a lot of things since then. But the person in this side of the circle threw some money out on the floor. And I picked up the, because I asked, you know, I didn't know how I was going to get home. And I didn't know it had the, that was my expense money on the floor. And so I picked up the money and I walked out of the circle, and that had become God to me, and I had no idea. So when I started to work those second and third steps, I had a lot of religious wounds, you know, and they didn't have anything to do with God, but I was so confused with it all. And my sponsor encouraged me to do a God inventory, to write down everything I ever thought God was as a child, you know, things that have happened to me in churches, anything that I could think of, any resentments, any, you know, harms, anything that, and I saw, wrote it all out. And I began to see through doing that process that those things that I thought were God had nothing to do with God. I also started keeping a God journal, and I started writing down all those little bitty gifts that I would get during the day that were evidence there was a power greater than me in my life. You know, and sometimes there were big things and sometimes there were small things. You know, getting a hug when you needed it, getting a phone call, having some money come in the mail when you didn't really expect it. And Dick and I had some real financial trouble around that time, and we got to a point that we honestly did not know if we had money for food. And I was terrified. And I was also full of self-centered pride. I wasn't willing to tell anybody. And we were both in service by then. And, you know, I thought it would reflect badly on the program if people knew we were struggling. And I got down on my knees. Now, I'll tell you that Dick and I had a dog named Booger Bear. And if you've ever looked at the word dog in a mirror, you know, you turn the word around and it's God. And I, he taught me so much about unconditional love, Booker Baird did. It was just, he, you know, you could leave the room and he was excited to see you again when you came back, you know, even if it was 2 minutes later. He just was the most loving example of unconditional love for me. And he really became my child. And I got down on my knees that day, and Booker Bear would pray with me. He'd get down on his knees. He'd put his head on the bed when I would pray. And so I asked God for help. I didn't know what to do. And 2 hours later, there was a friend of mine at the front door with 8 bags of groceries. And it took that 8 bags of groceries at my front door for me to finally take the second and third step. And, you know, there's that moment for many people. Now, this was not a small ray of hope. This was a huge, dramatic, this was like the Bill Wilson light for me, 8 bags of groceries when I was desperate. And that was an unbelievable transforming moment for me, you know. And I suddenly believed that the God of my understanding loved me, you know. I believed early on that God loved alcoholics, you know. I loved coming to speaker meetings from the very beginning, and I'm in awe to see people I love and respect so much sitting on this front row. I just that hope that I would get in hearing people's story. The first story I heard was Jack Sullivan, and you know, the story, he was living in a cardboard box and then his family restored to him. I mean, you know, there were so many examples that there was a God of our understanding in this program, but it took 8 bags of groceries to help me believe that hope for myself. I had a lot of self-centered pride, and I really didn't realize how much. You know, we were struggling. We were starting to pull out a little bit financially at that time, and a friend of ours had given me this beat-up old drunk car, okay? It was a green bomb, you know, the ugly puke green color, and the top of the roof was rusted out, and in the hood was rusted the words, "Judy loves Donnie." Okay, and the headliner was falling down. The air conditioner didn't work, and nothing I did could keep the headliner up. So there was like that dust underneath the headliner that would blow out back windows when you had the windows down, and then the back lights were broken out, so there was reflective tape over them. This was a lovely car, and but because of the way it looked, I couldn't be grateful for the fact that somebody had given me this gift. You know, I couldn't see the gift for the way it looked. And so when I'd go to meetings, I'd park it a couple blocks away, and I'd walk the rest of the way to the meeting like I was a very healthy person. And when I was able to drive that car in the parking lot, things started transforming. You know, it was just that hope of letting go of pretenses, you know, of being able to have somebody be able to see who I was and not have to hide that underneath a bushel or something. And so from that point on, I didn't have to hide who I was anymore. I didn't know who I was for a while, but the program started transforming me. In 2005, the end of 2004, Booker Bear died. And as I said, you know, he was 18, and Dick and I held him in our arms while we put him to sleep, and we buried him in the backyard. And I don't think either one of us realized how much, I mean, I don't think we thought we would ever grieve more than that. And I'm not sure that I ever have, honestly, with everything else that's happened. But you know, Booker Bear taught me how to love, and it was part of that hope that showed me that there was a God of my understanding, and he taught me how to grieve and let go at the same time. And little did I know how much I needed it, because within 2 months, my mom and dad both died 10 days apart. And that particular year was one of those years that earthbound people, folks that aren't in this room, people that work in the addiction field, where I happen to work, people that I, you know, knew in other circles, just did not understand how I was functioning. In that year, I lost my mom and dad. Dick was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. He wasn't able to tell me to start with because of all the loss we'd already had. I'm not going to tell that whole story right now because we don't have time, but y'all know that he survived. And there were so many gifts in that year, and his mother died in the middle of his early recovery from that cancer, and he lost his ability to work for almost 2 years. And so from a human point of view, it was more than most people could have survived very well. But it was the most spiritual year I ever had. Because what I found in the middle of that year was there was no way I could survive except looking for hope every day. And what I began to do is finally realize that I had never really learned what one day at a time was all about. I'd lived the majority of my life looking back or forward, and I was never present in my own life. You know, I was looking at what happened to me yesterday, what I had to feel sorry for, what resentments I was holding on to, what you had done to me, or was looking at tomorrow, what you might do to me, what might happen, what I had to worry about, what I had to stress about, how was I going to get through that, how was I going to pay that bill, and I never saw today. And it took that experience for me to recognize that the only way I was going to survive this life was to look for God in the gift of each day. And tremendous gifts happened in the middle of that. And my guess is they were always there, but I just never really saw them. I never opened my eyes enough to see what God truly had in my life, what God had really given to me in my life. The day that my dad died, Dick was supposed to be in Colorado, and the day before he had been out on the tarmac at Hartsfield for a very long time, and he about almost 3 hours, and they brought the plane back in, and they deplaned everybody and said, we're going to have to get another one. It's going to be another couple hours, and he was the Friday night speaker at a conference in Colorado, and he had to call him and tell him he wasn't going to get there. So he was home with me. You know, God wanted him home with me when we got that call that my dad had passed. And what also happened around that time, actually the first time I saw it was the day that Booger Bear died. This blue heron started showing up at our house. Every day we lease a house out in Douglas County. It's on 11 acres with an 8-acre lake. It was a true gift of God that we're at this place. And we're between a trailer park and a flea market. It's, you know, it's an interesting place to live. When we first moved in, we were across from the Curl Up and Die hair salon. It's now a tree cutting company. But, I mean, serious, that was the name of it. And Just Right Damn Promise is a porta potty company, okay? So, but we have this, you know, we have this lovely, lovely lake in the middle of all this, and this blue heron started, and the blue heron was there that day that our dog died, the day that my dad died, and 10 days later when my mother died. And it was this ray of hope, you know. I've looked up in a couple different cultures. Native American, Chinese symbolism, you know, and the blue heron is the symbol of God's love in one, and peace and contentment in another, and you know, so I get blue herons when I need it the most, and I don't see the blue heron all the time. I think it lives around the lake somewhere, but I only see it the days I need it. So I started getting that gift. You know, my dad died. We had this funeral. We went off to an AA conference. We're in Hilton Head on Monday. We decided to stay over a day. And we get a call. My mother's been found non-responsive and rushed to the hospital. And we rush back. And Dick's angry. And I'm in shock. And we pull over at a Wendy's to go to the bathroom. And I go in. And on the Muzak, playing on the Muzak, in the Wendy's, was How Great Thou Art. And we had just sung that hymn at my dad's service. You know, what a gift, what a ray of hope in a horrible day, you know. A reminder. I've never heard, I actually had to ask somebody if it was really playing, and it was. So, but I never heard Christian music in a Wendy's before or since. It's just that one time when I needed it the most. You know, living life looking at the glass half empty is not a particularly great way of living, but that's what I've been doing, you know. And beginning to see the glass half full and see God's love in the things that happened in my life and being able to see those moments is truly living life with a new pair of glasses, like Chuck said so long ago. You know, my life and my ability to see my life has transformed. There were many more things that happened that year. You know, I was sitting out on my back porch, having lost both my parents and having that moment of doubt and just said, oh, God, I wish somehow or other I knew they were actually with you and together. And 30 seconds later, a shooting star went across the sky. You know, when Dick was diagnosed with cancer and lost his ability to work, we really did not know how we were going to survive financially. And it was almost like the end of It's a Wonderful Life. Money just started showing up in the mail, and from some of y'all in this room and others. And seeing life through God's eyes, seeing God's love, seeing that hope, and beginning to live life a different way took me a whole lot longer than I would have liked to have thought. But my life really never needs to be the same again. And that's only because of these two fellowships and because of the love of people in the program and the love of the God I'm understanding. Do you have anything else you'd like to share, Linda?
Well, I'm very moved by your presentation. What kept coming up for me in because of what you said was we have to keep hitting that bottom, and we have more than one. And we hit that place, and we become more willing to change one more time. And then we recycle the steps, at least I do. You know, we've been going through some real financial issues in the last couple of years, and it's been hard, but it's been great because I've had to look at me in a different way. I've had to have that surrender one more time, and I've had to up my reliance and dependence and love for my God, because when things are going well, sometimes I get smug or complacent. I know I get arrogant. I hate that word, but it's certainly part of me. And when things are different, I have to collapse again. And in the collapse, I get to be reborn. And there's so much power that is out there. And if we just keep tapping in, and I don't know why I have to be the kind of person who has to hurt to re-tap. Now, that isn't always the case, but when I am down, it is always the case that I plug in at a different socket or I plug in at a different level. And so what we've been going through has been tough, but important. You know, we both have a program to work, and we work it, and as a result of working it together, I don't know that we'd kill each other, but we sure wouldn't have had much fun in the last couple of years. And it's because of the fact that we have a power greater than ourselves who restores us to sanity. It's just wonderful. It's just wonderful. I think that's all I do have to say. Thank you.
Just a couple other things I thought about. You know, the footprints thing that most of you've read at some point, and I didn't bring it with me, but, you know, that when we're hurting the most, there's only one set of footprints because God's holding us. And I think that's a lot about, you know, being strong at the broken places, being able to see God's love for us more in that broken place. I'll close, but actually going back and telling you just a little piece of that experience when Dick had cancer. You know, he didn't want to tell me because he was afraid of how of everything that I'd gone through. He didn't want me to worry about losing him, and he was also just that we'd lost our dog and my parents and him in the same year was just too much. And so, but I finally did know, and we were headed up to Rochester, New York, which we found out was the best place to have surgery. And for a Georgia girl, you don't want to go to Yankee Land to have your husband make his passage. So we had we made all these calls, and we had all these people. We arrived at the hotel, you know, and we had a new AA and Al-Anon home group waiting on us. You know, because we've been active in service and we've had the gift of speaking. We made some phone calls and these people came together and we arrived at this hotel and they're a group of people we don't know but are already our friends waiting on us. And what a ray of hope that was. And the next day we went to, and Dick had really had a very dark place during that time, and he had come to start reciting the 23rd Psalm over and over again, and it had meant so much to him, and it just came to him, and it helped him come through that experience. And we walked into this hospital, and we decided we would go to the chapel and pray. And we walked into the chapel, and on the wall in big gold letters was the 23rd Psalm. And we knew we were in the right place. And we walked out in the lobby, and there was a plaque. We were at Strong Memorial Medical Center, a part of the University of Rochester, and we started reading about the founder, and it was Leonard Strong, who was Bill Wilson's brother-in-law, who had founded the Alcoholic Foundation, who had saved his life the first time, and we just knew we were in the right place. You know, those moments of hope, those moments of God's love that shine down on us to let us know we're going to be okay, and they're always there if you look for them. And I thank y'all for...
Yeah, one more thing.
Okay.
I was always a person who looked at the world as the cup that was half empty. And now I look at the world in a different way. It's half full. But my new commitment to life, and one that I invite all of us to do, because I try to do it every day, is to just ask God for a bigger cup. And that's what I do. I want a really big cup. Thanks.
Thank you.